Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 61, Annexation, Making Boston Bigger for 150 Years. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to discuss an important era in Boston's history. In the latter half of the 19th century, Boston transformed itself from a tiny town on a peninsula to a sprawling city. In part, this was due to landmaking in the Back Bay in South Boston, but the city gained a great amount of area by annexing its neighbors. The first was Roxbury, which joined the city of Boston 150 years ago this week. Dorchester, Brighton, West Roxbury, and Charlestown would follow. Other towns, like Cambridge and Brookline, would not. Find out why in this week's show. But before we talk about Boston's annexations, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
Our featured historic site this week is going to take us right to the heart of the Siege of Boston. In April of 1775, long simmering tensions between the people of Massachusetts and the Crown government erupted into war. After colonial militias turned back the British march to Concord, the British regulars fell back to Boston. The militia, and later the Continental Army, would surround the city in a siege that lasted until March of 1776. As the Patriots consolidated their siege lines, they fortified a series of hilltop strong points around the city. The Patriots were unsuccessful at holding onto Bunker Hill, but they were able to build strong forts at several other high points around the peninsula of Boston. The best known is probably Prospect Hill in Somerville, which anchored the northern end of the lines, and now hosts an annual parade and celebration honoring the raising of the first American flag on New Year's Day in 1776. Another citadel anchored the southern end of the Patriot lines in Roxbury, and today, it's not as well known outside its neighborhood. At the time, there was only one road out of Boston on the narrow neck of land that connected it to the shore. That road roughly followed today's Washington Street. Near downtown Roxbury, at least what passed for downtown in 1775, stood a hill with a commanding view of the road to Boston and a strategic crossroads. Under the direction of Colonel Henry Knox, who you might know better for bringing cannons from Fort Ticonderoga to Boston, two forts were built: Roxbury Low Fort and Roxbury High Fort. British maps of the Patriot lines trace the outlines of these forts in careful detail, as any attack out of Boston overland would have to march directly towards them. The strong earthworks at the High Fort gave the hill the name that it and the surrounding neighborhood is known by today, Fort Hill.
What looks like a fairy tale castle at the top of Fort Hill is actually a 19th century standpipe, or water tower. Built in 1869, the tall, slender tower has brilliant white walls, a bright green roof, and slit windows. Once upon a time, it was open to the public with a wrought iron balcony for taking in the views. Its purpose, however, was practical. Water from the Cassituate Reservoir would be pumped up into the tank hidden within the Fort Hill standpipe so that gravity could then provide pressurized water to the surrounding community. The hill got a facelift in 1895 after famed landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted designed the current park, with walking paths, benches, and decorative walls of Roxbury pudding stone highlighting the remaining earthworks. Since the park and tower got another makeover in 2013, now is the perfect time to plan a visit. Just aim toward the white tower with a green roof that's visible from much of the city, or look for directions, a British map showing the fort, and photos in this week's show notes.
A few weeks ago, we put out a call on social media for folks who'd like to have their history events highlighted on the podcast. This week's event is one of the responses we received from a historian named G.A. DiGregorio. He's a former archaeologist, a former historical interpreter for the National Park Service, and a professor of history. He's also the host of a show called History Shorts with the Artifactual Historian. On January 17th, he'll be giving a talk at Wheaton College about the historical roots of the modern Middle East called The Great Loot. Here's how he describes it. As the old Ottoman Empire was decaying, Britain and France sought to bolster their own imperial interests in the Middle East. At the same time, a rising tide of Arab nationalism and Jewish Zionism led to an ever-growing political complexity in the region. This talk will examine the period between 1913 and 1948 to look at the origins of the current instability in the area. It's a free lecture as part of the NICE series, which is the Norton Institute for Continuing Education. Check out the show notes this week for a link to more details about the event.
Since that lecture neither takes place in Boston nor relates to Boston history, we figured we'd throw in an extra upcoming event this week. On December 1st, 1973, a visitor at the Harvard Fogg Museum left behind a paper shopping bag with a small box inside marked with the label of the Harvard Coop. A few minutes before closing time, the guard at the front desk got a call from a man asking if he could come in that evening to pick up the package from the coop, because it contained his daughter's birthday present. The guards relented, and just after midnight, the man knocked on the locked door of the museum. When the guard on duty let the man in, he brandished a gun and tied up and blindfolded the guard. A few accomplices arrived, and in less than 10 minutes, they made off with millions of dollars worth of antique Greek and Roman coins. This Sunday, Historic Newton is hosting a free talk on the heist and its relationship to an eccentric Newton coin collector as part of their free weekend at the Jackson Homestead Museum and the Durant Kenrick House. The talk will be held on Sunday, January 7th at 2:30 p.m. Check out this week's show notes for details.
And with that, it's time to turn to our main topic for this week. In the middle of the 19th century, there were two changes in Boston that led to a sort of suburban flight, similar to the white flight many cities witnessed after World War II. One was demographic, and the other was technological. It's hard to understate how different Boston looked before the 1840s. It was a small, densely populated city on a tiny, mitten-shaped peninsula. It was relatively homogeneous, with a population that was mostly English-descended, fairly well-off, and almost universally Protestant. It was the old Yankee ideal. When the potato famine began in 1845, an enormous wave of Irish immigration washed over Boston, like most other East Coast cities. By the time of the 1850 census, Irish immigrants and their children made up about 60,000 out of Boston's population of 135,000. At the same time, railroads were being introduced throughout the region. In 1835, the first regional rail lines connected Boston with Worcester, Providence, and Lowell. And over the coming decades, the network filled in to include many smaller towns. Railroads offered commuted fares to short-distance passengers with no luggage, leading to the rise of the term commuter. By the 1850s, a web of horse-drawn streetcar tracks connected Boston to the surrounding towns. For the first time, it was easy to keep a business in Boston but make your home in another community. Because Yankee Boston held the new Irish-American residents of their city with utter disdain, the suburbs began to look increasingly attractive. Well into the latter half of the 19th century, many of the towns immediately surrounding Boston maintained a more rural character. On the one hand, moving from the hustle-bustle of Boston to the leafy quiet of Brookline or Roxbury could be a relief for a family worried about the corrupting influence of their Irish neighbors. On the other hand, learning that your new hometown had muddy dirt streets, outhouses, and lacked an adequate supply of clean drinking water could be quite a rude surprise for a proper Yankee family. As Lawrence Kennedy said in his book, Planning the City Upon a Hill, no sooner did people move to the suburbs than they wanted to make the suburbs part of the city. Suburban voters wanted the city to provide services, but the city was at times reluctant to accept new expenses.
Roxbury was the first city to petition to be allowed to join itself to the city of Boston. The state legislature took up their request in 1852, hearing arguments from both sides. The case laid out by supporters of annexation focused on the infrastructure benefits for Roxbury, saying that there is wanted an abundant supply of pure water without great cost, that in the upper part of the town we have to penetrate the rocks, and in the lower part it was impossible at any price to obtain pure water, that attempts to obtain artesian wells are abandoned, that we want common sewers, and that in order to drain Roxbury, we must connect with the sewers of Boston. That we want better streets. The present condition of our streets is not good. That sidewalks are wanted. A general system. The Boston system. To compel persons to make sidewalks.
Opponents framed the debate as Big Bad Boston rapaciously plundering its smaller neighbor, arguing that Boston wants to add to her commercial importance. that Boston wants to increase the number of her citizens who will take and pay for the constituent water, and that we shall pay her a large tax for her water. That Boston wants our public property. That Boston wants us to pay our share of her public debt. That by uniting with Boston, we may make a successful effort to save the capital of our state from falling under the control of foreigners. That we are opposed by the city officers, by the bank, or by money power, by those who have peculiar private interests, by honest-minded men who have been misled, and by disinterested and fair-minded men who fear all change. The legislature heard arguments from both sides, but in the end, decided they couldn't be sure that the request to join Boston was fully supported by the residents of both cities. And in the end, they asked the Roxbury Committee to withdraw their petition.
As you might have guessed from the fact that, spoiler alert, Roxbury is now a neighborhood in the city of Boston, this wasn't the last time the legislature heard arguments on the matter of annexing Roxbury to Boston. Bills to that effect were introduced in 1859, 1860, and 1865, but none of them got enough support to pass both houses. In 1866, the cities of Boston and Roxbury formed a joint commission to study the prospect of annexation. Their February 1867 final report said, "We are led by our investigation of this subject to the conviction that immediate annexation is equally important to Boston and Roxbury. We are satisfied that in all material respects, the two communities are nearly equal in the advantages which each offers to the other, and we believe that the welfare of both will be greatly promoted by the early consummation of annexation." Reading that, and seeing the cooperation between the communities, the legislature nearly passed a bill that May immediately absorbing Roxbury into Boston, but it was vetoed at the last minute by Governor Bullock.
Do you ever wonder why the ceremony and parade celebrating Evacuation Day, when the British left Boston, is held in South Boston? Every elementary school student knows that the cannons Henry Knox brought from Fort Ticonderoga were installed at Dorchester Heights, but today, Dorchester Heights is a part of South Boston. As the name suggests, Dorchester Heights was part of Dorchester Neck, which was, in turn, originally part of the independent town of Dorchester. From the time of settlement to the beginning of the 1800s, Dorchester Neck was sparsely populated. In 1800, there were 10 families living on the peninsula, and in 1803, a rumor started circulating that they had all sold their land to a West Indian planter who wanted to move to Boston. Soon, the truth was revealed. All 10 families had sold their farms to a syndicate of real estate speculators led by Harrison Gray Otis. Otis was the 1803 equivalent of a billionaire, and he was a prominent member of the Federalist Party. He was a former U.S. attorney and member of the state legislature, and he would eventually go on to become the Boston mayor and a U.S. senator. He used his political connections to convince the state legislature to pass legislation in 1804 ceding Dorchester Neck to Boston, without asking the people of either town and without providing any sort of compensation to Dorchester. Otis and his partners built a bridge connecting Dorchester Neck to downtown Boston, renamed it South Boston, and immediately proceeded to subdivide and sell the land, making a bundle of money. This time, the legislature was going to make sure that there was no appearance of malfeasance. The bill was resubmitted with an amendment requiring a majority of voters in both cities to approve of annexation before it could move forward. It guarded against annexation, as one history of the city puts it, without consulting the people of a municipality which had had a corporate existence for 237 years as to their willingness to be absorbed by their greater neighbor, nor those of the city of Boston, who might be decidedly averse to undertaking jurisdiction over new territory and to assuming the Roxbury debt. This version of the bill passed through both houses and was signed by the governor within a few hours of being submitted.
Now it was up to the voters. On September 9, 1867, both cities went to the polls and voted for annexation in a landslide. Every ward of both cities approved of the measure. The residents of Roxbury voted in the affirmative by a 3-to-1 margin, and Boston went for annexation by over 4-to-1. The measure went into effect the next year, and on January 6, 1868, 150 years ago this Saturday, the independent city of Roxbury ceased to exist. While the debate over annexing Roxbury dragged on, Boston was expanding in other ways. Harrison Griotis and his partners had subdivided South Boston. As we heard in a recent episode, the city had filled in the mill pond that used to divide the North and West Ends and built a new neighborhood. And starting in 1858, work began on an ambitious new project to fill the tidal back bay and create a large, planned neighborhood that would itself double the original size of the Shawmut Peninsula. This seemingly inexorable progress created in the minds of the people and government of Boston what author Stephen Puleo calls a sense of municipal entitlement, what one might call a sense of urban manifest destiny. Just a year after Roxbury joined the city, the Cosituate Standpipe was built atop Fort Hill. Its gleaming white walls, pitched green roof, and ample supply of clean water stood as a monument to the march of progress and the expansion of Boston that was visible from the surrounding communities. However, not everyone shared that sense of optimism about the growth of Boston through annexation. As Roxbury became more urban and industrialized, in fact more like Boston, the portion of that city that was still rural and wished to remain that way rebelled. The people of what was then called Upper Roxbury, today the neighborhoods of Jamaica Plain, Roslindale, and West Roxbury, petitioned the state legislature to allow them to separate from Roxbury and to return to a town government instead of continuing as a city. In a committee report, their representatives said, "Here is an abundant territory for a large town of a rural description. Beautiful sites for country residences and farming, containing 3,000 inhabitants, who nearly all desire a separation, who are entirely competent, and wish to govern themselves, their social feelings and sympathies being in a different direction."
In the book Eden on the Charles, Michael Rawson describes the residents of Upper Roxbury as the industrialists who built the factories, the real estate speculators who owned the slums, the bankers who financed a new development, and sometimes their clerks who kept the whole system running. Ironic, then, that they wished to separate from the city of Roxbury because it was becoming too industrial, too densely populated, and too full of the new immigrants who were flocking to Boston. In an honest moment, perhaps too honest, one of their representatives said that the people of Upper Roxbury wished to get rid of the lower portion on account of the pauper population. In the end, they were successful, and the new town of West Roxbury was set off from Roxbury in 1851, just as the annexation debate was beginning to heat up. It was just one in a series of partitions between rapidly urbanizing cities and their rural fringes. Somerville was split off from Charlestown, then Revere separated from Chelsea, and Swampscott and Nahant both broke from Lynn. However, this fragmentation was the exception, not the rule. To quote Rawson again, "Cities across America would feed their growth throughout the 19th century by annexing their rural neighbors. Annexation provided a way to recapture the wealth of former residents who had moved to surrounding communities, and it enabled cities to control areas that would someday house a portion of their populations. Some cities, like Detroit, nibbled slowly at their countrysides over many years. Others, like Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York, swallowed enormous areas with a single bite. But all large cities grew larger through annexation."
That sense of urban manifest destiny was certainly on display when, less than a year after the annexation of Roxbury, the Boston City Council created a commission to study the idea of annexing the town of Dorchester in December of 1868. Unsurprisingly, given the triumphant attitude in Boston at the time, they concluded in early 1869, "The importance of retaining the industrial classes of our community within the city limits cannot be overestimated. An industrious, intelligent mechanic who has a family and is laboring to place his children in a better position than he has been able to attain is a most valuable man in any community. To retain such men, we must be able to give them land at moderate prices. They will always remain in the city if they can live as cheaply and comfortably as elsewhere, not only because the interests of their labor are here, but because of its better facilities of education, recreation, libraries, and other advantages which the metropolis affords." As far as the commission was concerned, the benefits to the city of Boston were clear. There were benefits in improving the harbor, in improving the street grid, in establishing new parks and cemeteries. But most of all, there were benefits to be had in demographics. Timely provision should be made for the acquisition of territory of large capacity, bordering closely upon the city, in the direction of movement of population, best adapted to our existing system of water distribution, drainage, etc., a territory which we shall have the power to shape at small expense for the healthful occupation of our increasing population. Dorchester seems to your commissioners to present these important requisites. This pitch didn't necessarily go over so well in Dorchester itself. Dorchester had a history just as long as Boston's, with both towns being founded in 1630. In 1869, the city of Dorchester was the second most populous municipality in the state, with almost as many residents as Boston. One opponent of annexation announced at a rally that the laboring men of Dorchester were a higher class than those of Boston. And another, feeding off the widespread resentment of Yankee New England toward recent immigrants, went as far as saying that the Irish of Boston would not make very desirable neighbors. After a very contentious debate on the topic, the question of annexation was put to a vote on June 4, 1869. The measure was wildly popular in Boston, passing with a 6-1 margin. In Dorchester, however, it came right down to the wire. In the end, annexation prevailed, but the measure only passed by a mere 202 votes. On January 3, 1870, the independent city of Dorchester was officially absorbed by the city of Boston, nearly doubling the size of the already combined Boston and Roxbury, and completely dwarfing the original landmass of the Shawmut Peninsula, where Boston began.
As we've heard, the movement toward annexation had two major motivations. The old Yankee power base wanted to maintain control over a population that was increasingly made up of Catholic Irish immigrants. And the suburban towns surrounding Boston were scrambling to provide basic services for their growing populations. Boston now had access to the clean, plentiful water provided by the Cassituate Reservoir in Natick. We had a sophisticated sewer system, and planning was underway for a major upgrade called the Main Drain that would unite all of the city's sewage lines and send our waste out into the harbor on the outgoing tide. And we had the Emerald Necklace system of parks. Our suburban neighbors looked on the city's advances jealously, but seemed powerless to institute such improvements themselves. The Cassituate Reservoir and Aqueduct had been completed at tremendous expense, supported by the large tax base of the city. The Main Drain and the existing sewage system took a similar outlay of resources, while the public park system demanded a strong centralized planning authority. The towns surrounding Boston didn't have all the same advantages. Some, like West Roxbury, were quite wealthy, but lacked access to the natural resources it would have taken to implement a central water or sewer system. Others, like Charlestown, had access to the Mystic River for water and the harbor for disposing of sewage, but had no money with which to make improvements taking advantage of these resources. And all of the suburban towns suffered from a lack of central planning. At the time, there was no sense of wider metropolitan planning and development, so the only access to these resources was at the city level. Recognizing the growing need for broad, coordinated planning efforts between the urbanizing towns in Greater Boston, a state senator named J.S. Potter from Arlington introduced a bill in 1872 that would have annexed 15 surrounding cities and towns to Boston. He argued that this was necessary both to improve the quality of life in these smaller municipalities by providing public services, but also to ensure that the rural character of these outlying areas would maintain the moral fiber of the growing city. Wherever a family has a grapevine or owns and cultivates a flower bed, there a voter is sure to be found who cannot be properly enumerated among those who belong to what are termed the dangerous classes, he said.
The legislature entertained the measure, but in the end they set goals that were not quite so lofty. Rather than 15 cities and towns, the bill that passed through committee proposed annexing 4 of Boston's immediate neighbors: Brighton, Brookline, West Roxbury, and Charlestown. All of them had earlier split off from other towns: Brighton from Cambridge, West Roxbury from Roxbury, Charlestown from Somerville, and Brookline from Boston itself in 1705. The annexation debate would play out in very different ways in these different towns. Charlestown and West Roxbury were in desperate need of the city's services Boston could provide. West Roxbury had shed much of the rural chauvinism that had driven it to separate from Roxbury, while Charlestown had gone as far as electing a mayor who campaigned on an explicitly pro-annexation platform. Brighton and Brookline were each situated somewhat differently. Brighton's main industry at that time was livestock and meat. For reasons that we'll explore in another episode one of these days, it was our own little Wild West, with stockyards, drovers, saloons, and regular cattle drives through the streets. Starting in the early 1870s, the local livestock market took a sudden nosedive. On the one hand, the refrigerated train car had just been invented, making it much more economical to slaughter cows and pack meat nearer to the ranches of the Midwest. And on the other hand, the state had gotten sick of Brighton's meat industry acting as a bad neighbor to the surrounding communities. The stockyards were full of manure, while the slaughterhouses discharged a foul stench into the air and a disgusting mix of offal into the Charles River. A new state board of health stepped in and shut down many of the slaughterhouses and forced others to consolidate. This left a town with a cleaner reputation, with large tracts of land suddenly available for development. Brookline in the same era had maintained the rural, wealthy sensibilities that the founders of West Roxbury had hoped to instill. At this time, it claimed to be the wealthiest town in Massachusetts, with gently winding lanes connecting the town's large estates and their manor houses. Having read the writing on the wall when the annexation debate started in the early 1850s, the town of Brookline worked furiously to provide the public services on its own that were driving other towns into the welcoming arms of Boston. It already had omnibus service, a branch railroad, and a growing street railway network to serve the commuter class who called the town home. By the end of the 1850s, according to Rawson, Brookline had one of the best school systems and public libraries outside of Boston, and gaslights illuminated the streets of its most settled areas. By the 1870s, the town had established a full-time police force, completed its own waterworks, and begun a large-scale system of sewers. It even enjoyed limited telephone service. An election was held to decide the fate of these four towns on October 7, 1873. As an article published in the Boston Pilot 3 days before the election makes clear, success was widely predicted. Judging from the opinions of the press of Boston and vicinity, the annexation of Brighton, Brookline, Charlestown, and West Roxbury is looked upon as inevitable. The voters of Boston approved all four annexations. Charlestown and West Roxbury passed theirs, and in Brighton, more than 80% voted in favor of annexation. However, in Brookline, the measure failed. Voters turned out against it by a measure of more than 4-1 against. At the insistence of the legislature, Brookline went back to the polls to defeat annexation in 1875 and again in 1876. It hadn't been a fluke or a misunderstanding. The town of Brookline was not interested in joining Boston. The arguments that Brookline needed to join Boston to receive public services had fallen on deaf ears.
Nobody knew it at the time, but Brookline's rejection of annexation would prove to be the high watermark of urban consolidation nationally. Kenneth Jackson says in the book Crabgrass Frontier, "After Brookline spurned Boston, virtually every other eastern and middle western city was rebuffed by wealthy and independent suburbs. Chicago by Oak Park and Evanston, Rochester by Brighton and Irondequoit, or however you pronounce that lovely city, and Oakland by the rest of Alameda County. Brighton, West Roxbury, and Charlestown joined the city on New Year's Day, 1874. The idea of annexation would never go away entirely, but it would basically be taken off the table for the next 40 years. In the meantime, the problem of public services began to be tackled at a regional level, lessening the need for suburbs to join themselves to the city of Boston in order to get access to resources and centralized planning. The legislature created a new body called the Metropolitan Sewage Commission in 1889 to manage drainage across Boston and its suburbs. In 1893, they created a Metropolitan Parks Commission to do the same thing with parklands, beginning with the Middlesex Fells and the Blue Hills. And finally, in 1895, the Metropolitan Water Board began extending municipal water supplies to communities as much as 10 miles outside of Boston. So by the end of the 19th century, the problems of fresh water, open space, and sanitary sewers were being dealt with on a regional basis, rather than driving independent towns to annex themselves to Boston. Still, the dream of a city encompassing the entire region didn't go away. For a time, the Yankee Republican Party pushed for consolidation in hopes that their suburban voting power would outweigh the immigrant Irish Democrats in the city, giving control of Boston back to the Brahmin class. Years later, when it was clear that the balance of power had shifted firmly in the other direction, Mayor Honey Fitz Fitzgerald, JFK's grandfather, pushed a plan for urban consolidation starting in 1905. Under the moniker Boston 1915, it argued that 40 towns should be annexed, from Salem to Cohasset, and almost as far west as Worcester.
While city and state politicians were arguing about the Boston 1915 plan, a more modest proposal passed the legislature. Rather than having been initiated by political bosses in Boston, or dreamed up by urban planning fanatics in the state legislature, this one was championed by the people of the town that would be annexed. In episode 59 about the Motherbrook, we talked a little bit about how Hyde Park was created in 1868 out of pieces of Dorchester, Milton, and Dedham. With abundant water power provided by the Motherbrook and the Neponset River, it quickly became a manufacturing center. The population grew from 1,500 to 15,000 in the 25 years leading up to annexation, as Italian, Irish, and Jewish immigrants streamed in to work in the mills. In his book Planning the City Upon a Hill, Lawrence Kennedy describes the debate within Hyde Park over annexation. Robert Bleakey, owner of a local woolen mill, led the movement for annexation. His supporters were mainly immigrants. Opposition came from the Yankee population. Longtime Hyde Park residents recall the split taking form along religious as well as ethnic lines, since the Protestant churches opposed joining Boston, while the Catholic Church was for it. Boston officials coveted the tax revenue the city would gain from the factories in Hyde Park despite the town's $10 million debt. The election was held on November 7, 1911, and the annexation measure passed in both towns. When Hyde Park officially joined Boston on January 1, 1912, Boston was a city completely transformed in the preceding half century. From a tiny peninsula of just 600 acres, Boston had grown almost a hundredfold by creating new land and annexing its neighbors to over 57,000 acres. Its population had more than tripled, from 190,000 to about 680,000. Still, the question of annexation never got this far again. In 1912, Representative Daniel Kiley took a slightly scaled-back version of Honey Fitz's Boston 1915 plan before the legislature. The New York Times reported that his bill provides outright for the merging of all cities and towns coming within a 10-mile radius of the statehouse into a new city with an estimated population of 1.5 million. The bill would add to the present city the cities of Cambridge, Chelsea, Everett, Lynn, Malden, Medford, Melrose, Newton, Quincy, Somerville, Waltham, and Woburn, and the towns of Arlington, Belmont, Braintree, Brookline, Canton, Dedham, Hingham, Hull, Lexington, Milton, Nahant, Needham, Revere, Saugus, Stoneham, Wakefield, Wellesley, Weymouth, Winchester, and Winthrop. Needless to say, that bill failed. It would be the last time annexation was seriously considered by the city of Boston, but the idea rears its head from time to time. In 1991, the city of Chelsea went bankrupt, closing its schools and cutting police and fire services. Despite nearly $10 million of municipal debt, voters would not approve a tax increase to meet the shortfall. It was the first time since the Great Depression that a Massachusetts municipality had gone bankrupt, and there was a short period where nobody knew what the next step would be for the town. On September 12th, the New York Times reported, "Earlier this week, Boston's mayor Raymond L. Flynn offered to annex Chelsea if its residents wanted to join its vastly larger neighbor. Boston's leaders had previously expressed opposition to taking over Chelsea and inheriting its fiscal and political troubles. Luckily, the state appointed a receiver to turn Chelsea around before Boston had to make good on Ray Flynn's promise."
These days, interest in the topic of annexation seems to be restricted to real estate developers trying to make a quick buck and city planning nerds who make the same argument that's been widely rejected since the 1870s, that having one municipal government for the metropolitan area would make everything from public transit to snow removal simpler. The first of these two groups was on display in 2007, when a developer bought what used to be a giant Stop and Shop warehouse that straddled the town line between Dedham and Hyde Park. The developer planned to build almost 1,900 single-family homes on the site, but was stymied by lack of interest from Dedham. The only road in or out of the former warehouse site led into Boston. There was no access from the Dedham side. Dedham was not interested in building a new road or investing in running public utilities to it. The politically connected developers proposed a measure to annex the roughly 100-acre site into Boston, a move similar to how Harrison Gray Otis originally got Dorchester Heights annexed to Boston so that he could build a neighborhood on it. In this case, though, the proposal died before it came to a vote before the full legislature, much less going on to a ballot in Dedham and Boston. The city planning nerds still make an appearance from time to time, often in comments about local or regional planning proposals reported on by the news site Universal Hub. Sometimes, they take a page directly from Honey Fitzgerald's Boston 1915 plan, as was the case in an article published in Boston Magazine in 2013. Under the headline, Annex Brookline, it announced a plan to promote growth, expand our horizons, vanquish our neighbors, and restore our rightful place as the hub of the universe. The author proposed annexing Brookline, Cambridge, Chelsea, Everett, Malden, Quincy, Somerville, Arlington, Medford, Belmont, Watertown, and Milton, saying that it would result in a Boston with a pleasingly rotund shape and a population exceeding 1.25 million people, displacing Dallas as the 9th largest U.S. city. The article was meant to be tongue-in-cheek, and luckily, it seems that nobody in a position of power read it or took it seriously. We haven't heard much about annexing everything inside of 128 since then.
To learn more about the era of annexation in Boston, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/061. We'll have information about the books Planning the City Upon a Hill, Boston Since 1630 by Lawrence Kennedy, and Eden on the Charles, The Making of Boston, by Michael Rawson. We'll also link to historic maps and city documents from the debates about annexation, and to news articles about the annexations that didn't happen from 1991 until today. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and both of our upcoming events. Before the holidays, we released episode 59 about the Motherbrook, which was dug to draw water out of the Charles River to power mills. After listening to the show, William Ricker tweeted to us and said, "Baker's Chocolate Mill, Windmill in the North End, Tide Pond Mill. How did Motherbrook get such strange geography? It's all here. Thank you, great episode. Answers several questions I'd wanted to ask but hadn't." A listener who goes by M commented about the same episode on Facebook. "Just listen to the latest episode. Who knew Dedham was so fascinating? I'm going to do a day there. I just love industrial waterways." And a listener named Brian wrote in as well, saying, "Great episode. One, maybe two corrections, though. The first settlers of the town didn't name it Dedham. They wanted to call it Contentment, and it was the general court who decided to call it Dedham. Secondly, I don't know how it was said in 1641, but today, Whiting is pronounced Whiting and not Whitting, which is what we said in the episode, when referring to Whiting Ave or the family whose farm made up today's Oakdale neighborhood." We also got feedback from my mother on last week's classic episode. Hearing how I described her putting baby me in the basket on her bike and riding across the causeway to Boston Harbor's Long Island to watch the tall ships come in 1980, she responded, "I didn't put Jacob in a basket. He had a child seat on the back and a helmet. I think I have a photo somewhere to prove it."
If you'd like us to read your comments on the air, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a story about a local duel, just for you Hamilton fans.